say you're in this preparation period and you're like, man, I would love to do double thresholds. One of the things that Ryan and Sarah taught me just through observing is doing a cross training double workout.
Yeah.
I think that's a great place to begin, is hop on the bike and do, you know, 10 times 3 minutes on, 1 minute off on a workout day. You know, I'm 42. I'm not doing double thresholds. If I do a double day, I just hop on the bike or I swim or I do something else that has intensity with it.
If you're looking for training for your next race, marathon, half marathon, 5K, or you're just wanting to learn how to run, try signing up for a free consult. We'll provide you with the knowledge you need to see if Run Free is a good fit for you and your goals. We offer a super personal and super affordable coaching service. Please sign up on our website for a free consult. There are so many things that we're excited to deliver to our Run Free athletes this year, and we'd love to invite you to join us. On January 30th at 12 p.m. Eastern, we're doing a webinar on how to fuel for the marathon. Specifically, we're going to cover how to fuel for the Boston Marathon. And we'll have on the webinar our two nutritionists, Joe Butler and Cody Moore. We also have camp coming up this summer on June 19th through the 23rd. It's an adult-only camp in Flagstaff, Arizona, and you can register on our website.
Here is how I think of double thresholds in terms of what it is and the purpose and also the context of where it works well. So I think double threshold is actually a way to increase your volume of intensity without getting hurt. So I was explaining it to an athlete like this the other day. And I asked them the question, which is more intense of a workout? If I send you to the track and I have you do 10 400s with 2 minutes recovery to failure, where your goal is to your last 2 to 3 reps stumble home, like you're going to just thrash yourself, right? So it's a relatively short workout, but the intensity is crazy high.
Yeah.
And you are trying, and I wouldn't prescribe this to anybody, but I'm just creating an example, which is more stressful on your body, that workout, or if I send you to the track and have you do 8 times a K at slightly faster than your anaerobic threshold with a minute recovery. And then in the afternoon, I have you come back to the track and go a second per lap faster, but run 16 by 400 with 45 seconds recovery. And so I would actually argue the more stressful workout and the workout that has more injury potential is that 10 by 400 workout.
Yeah, the high stress.
You're going to complete failure and then you're creating like terrible running form. Like that's something we all try to avoid in running, is tearing yourself up. And so what I think double threshold really is it's a way to encourage the athlete to slow down enough to hit a pace that allows the anaerobic threshold to develop and also allows you to get pretty high volume. And I actually don't think the injury potential goes up. Yeah. I think it actually might even go down. And the athletes that I've prescribed it to in the last couple of years have all said they feel better in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And so if you went and did 10 by 400 and killed it, you're not going to feel better in the afternoon. So it's just, I think it's a way to make us as motivated and intense athletes run the right pace and mentally satisfied with, so I'll give you a specific example. So I've got a couple of high school athletes that I've had do a couple double threshold workouts, and these are 15, 30 guys. So they're running 5 minute pace and their anaerobic threshold is somewhere around 515, 520. So their Ks are like 317 to 310. So that's 510 to 520 pace. So they're just under anaerobic threshold. And then they come back in the afternoon and run 73s for 400. And they're getting in like 18 miles that day between the two workouts and warm up and cool down. And that's a great way to build volume. And they're fine. They're fine doing that. They're just running 73s.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I would like break it down in my mind and explain like what you're doing and why it's possible.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I thought that there was some interesting things, and to circle back a little bit, Marius, I can never pronounce his name.
I think it's Marius or Marius Bakken.
Yes. So we're kind of using him as like the primary person who like really developed it properly, I feel like. And then it's subsequently been adopted by, you know, Ingebrigtsen's, like really heavily popularized it. But a couple notable things that I feel like I picked up from him, and I totally agree with that, that I feel like, and this is something I feel like a lot of different people know, is when you look at other sports, runners aren't maximizing the amount of time that you possibly can because we're like pounding, right? Like, and one of the things that he was saying is that he thought that the recovery of the muscles was the primary limiting factor for runners, so that you get this like period of recovery between workouts. And it's not even like a tremendous amount of time. Like, I think it was only like 5 to 6 hours was kind of the recommendation. But that muscle recovery was the primary thing helping you to get more volume at threshold, right? So you're like really heavily, like you were talking about, whether which is a more stressful workout, doing 10 by 400 like all out, or doing multiple sessions a little bit slower, that essentially you can just accumulate a lot more time working towards your like anaerobic threshold, right? And like actually measuring, like and that seems to be where the Norwegians like just like to take specific measurements and do that well. So to me, that was a big characterization of, I think, what double threshold training is just, yeah, a focus on volume. The other thing that I thought was interesting is that like these are mid-distance runners, and even like you're talking about with your guys running big volume on those days, it's like the volume is big, right? Like you're doing actually like 180 kilometers a week, plus your threshold days end up being a lot of volume. So it seems like antithetical to a lot of like mid-distance training, right?
Well, and the other thing too is to just note, there are successful athletes that are not doing a ton of double thresholds. So yeah, it's not the only way, but it is an interesting way, because what if you are more prone, or what if you respond better to double thresholds than you do faster workouts?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what's happened, is we've taken athletes like Ingebrigtsen is not the fastest. And Nordis, the other Norwegian guy that ran, that was third behind Kerr, Ingebrigtsen, and Nordis in the world championships, he went from like 339 to 329 in this last season. Like, he had like a huge progression.
Yeah.
It might have only been 7 seconds, but it was like, I mean, that's an eternity.
He was also, I actually just watched a video about him, that his closing speed in the world champs, like he had the fastest last lap. Yeah.
Yep. That's right. And he did not see himself as fast.
Yeah.
In the past.
And that's such an interesting thing, because I found that, and I think this is to that point of like, some people maybe this type of training is not great for, but I think like high aerobic responders, and I'd put myself in that category of like, I remember in high school and college, the times where I felt like I had the best 400 speed was when I was doing a lot of tempo work and I was the most aerobically efficient, right? And yep, I was doing like actually probably the least amount of track work. Seemed like there was like a weird correlation between doing a lot of track work and actually not being that great of speed, you know?
Yeah. And when I was coaching in college, Matt Wood from Malone College was one of the guys coaches that I really liked to follow. And he had all of his guys doing like a lot of this type of workout, like double threshold, but he had them all together. So they do 13 miles of tempo, training for like 3K indoors.
Just one session though in the morning.
It'd be one session. And a lot of it would be like sets of 3 miles at threshold with breaks of 4 minutes. And then he'd do it again or mile repeats 13 times a mile. And so I think the interesting thing about the double session is if you do 10K in the morning, 10K in the afternoon, that's, you know, what is that? Just under 13 miles.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that's not a crazy workout to do 13 miles of workout. I mean, people do that all the time. And now splitting it into two sessions is allowing you to run slightly faster.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something like, I think there's like some underlying principles that I think are interesting and I would say sound. Like, I'm curious to actually get into this at some point. Like the splitting into two sessions seems like almost an extension of just doing also like the intervals, because it's not doing, at least for the mid distance guys, you're not doing a lot of sustained running. You're doing a lot of like 5 by 6 minutes or like 6 by 5 minutes. And then maybe you're doing like 400s in the afternoon. And that to me is like almost reminiscent of, I remember hearing about Jim Rine doing like 40 by 400 at like 440 pace, right? Where like that used to be more of a thing, I feel like, to do these ridiculous interval sessions where they're just long, right? Like it's not particularly challenging, but I mean, challenging probably from more of a mental capacity thing than I think even like a physiological.
So there was a guy, Toby Tanzer's book, Train Hard, Win Easy the Kenyan Way. This is an older book. I don't know if you ever looked in that. He's the guy that does Shoes for Africa.
Okay. I don't know if I've read his stuff.
He's built like 5 or 6 hospitals in Africa. It's like super cool guy. But I think I'm connecting the right person. But there was a guy in that book, a Kenyan, back in like Moses Tanui's time, that was doing 3 workouts a day. Dang. And he was staying at the track like all day long, and he was running a lower intensity, but he was hitting like crazy volumes on workout days. And so, yeah, I think there has been people in the past that have done these crazy workouts. And I think, didn't Jim Ryan also lift weights in between some of those sessions?
I think he might have. I mean, I think his coach was a swim coach who coached him in high school. So I feel like, and it's funny because I feel like swim coaches pop up in high performance, like in every sport. Like Jumbo Visma has a swim coach as their high performance advisor now. And it's interesting. I feel like they just have a different mindset towards training, where it's like, they're really not afraid of volume of interval sessions and shorter recovery. Like, it's just a different way of going about it, I feel like, than we tend to as runners.
You know what that makes me think of? It makes me think of people like Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, like these guys who are rumored to have trained 3 and 4 times a day.
Oh yeah. Just like go crazy with it.
Yeah. And here's the thing. They're not doing crazy sessions.
Yeah.
But the amount of time is bigger. And so that was actually one of the interesting things in that Marius Bakken article that we were looking at was he said that further developments potentially could be three sessions a day.
Yeah.
Of anaerobic threshold training. And he gave some parameters of a little bit lower lactate numbers. I think it was like 2.3 in the morning, 2.6, 3.3 in the afternoon. It was like an ascending order. And then there was also a caveat there about the lactic acid being possible of being higher in the afternoon. due to like metabolism or something.
Yeah, I did. I didn't totally get that, because that seems to be a common thing with the double threshold stuff, is that you typically do have slightly higher measurements in the afternoon than you would allow in the morning. And I don't know. Yeah, that's, it seems almost counter. Like, I would feel like from a mental standpoint, I would almost want to go like harder in the morning, then almost be like, okay, now the hard work's done. I can like kind of like it's almost like you have money in the bank going into the second workout. But I think from a physiological standpoint, it's better to do it that way, where you're kind of like,
well, and from the athletes that I've personally observed and given training to, there's a consistent theme that they feel better on the second one.
Yeah. Why?
And what? There's a collegiate program. I don't want to say what program it is, because I don't know if, I don't know the coach, and I don't want to like, you know, talk about a program that I don't know the coach about, but he has their athletes. I've got a couple athletes that I used to coach with Run Free that have gone on to college, and they're at this school, D1 school. They're doing 10 by a K in the morning on Tuesday. And then on Friday, on Tuesday morning. Okay. It's so great. I'm like getting ahead of myself. They're doing 10 by a K in the morning on Tuesday with a minute recovery, 10 by a K in the afternoon on Tuesday with a minute recovery. And then on Friday, 10 by a K in the morning with a minute recovery, and then 10 by a K in the afternoon with a minute recovery. And then on Sunday, they're doing hill repeats or a long run rotating. And they did a 10-week phase of 40 times a K per week.
Yeah.
In prep.
I mean,
that's a lot, dude.
That's a lot of work. Yeah. Yeah.
But they're running it at like 3 minutes, 258 to 309.
Yeah.
And these guys are 8 minute to 820. 3K guys.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, watching them, I think they're going to run amazing this year.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're going to kill it. Like, it's in the other caveat there is their second session is on the treadmill.
Okay. Is there a reason? I know that Mario said that too, right? Like stuff on the treadmill was very useful because it's such a controlled environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I observed is they're doing them in lane 7 and lane 8.
I imagine you're just limiting like the amount of turning that you're doing.
Yep. You're just limiting your inside leg stress.
Yeah.
And then they're also doing them on rotating directions.
Yeah.
So two one way, two the other way, two one way, two the other way.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, so, I mean, it's funny. So in getting ready for this podcast, I was thinking about how this is so like diametrically opposed to our last episode about sprinting, where we were talking about the skill set of running, right? And kind of making that a focal point to work on that. And something that Mario said in his was that it's this sort of methodology of focusing on the physiology is like, to me, the opposite of like not being overly focused on running race pace, right? Where like these guys are not necessarily like the Ingebrigtsens, when you look at the pacing that they're hitting for their workouts, like you would say they're hardly ever touching their sort of race paces, right? So he was saying that.
Well, so they are periodizing, yeah, and they are taking like a threshold in the morning, and then late, like mid prep, like pre competition phase, they're running 20 by 400 with 2 to 3 minutes in sets of 5.
Yeah,
and then they're running like 53, 52 for those 400s.
Yeah.
So they're getting into it. I think the double threshold without race pace would be like 10 weeks, and then they've got a pre-comp phase where they're getting after it, one workout every other week. And then they've got the competition phase where they're actually running like some really fast 200s and 300s.
Yeah. So you're just doing it in like close proximity to when you need to be able to do that. Right. Whereas, right. And I think it's not to say that like you don't, yeah, that you don't need to hit race pace or you don't need to run fast, but to say, I think sometimes, and I'm saying this cause I've done this with myself where I feel like it's a huge advantage to spend more and more time. And even like, I think a lot of coaches, like I think even Canova talked about trying to spend a lot more time towards the paces you need to run. Cause that does make logical sense. But this is taking, I think, a little bit of a different approach to it to say maybe you don't need to prioritize that as much to try to like just accumulate time at race pace, accumulating time maybe at like a slightly slower pace, but you're getting more volume and you're not getting injured and just your cumulative yeah. workload is high, right?
Yeah, I think it's like that. Man, I think this is why running is so interesting and coaching is so interesting is – it really is about knowing the athlete and figuring out, like, if you're more of an aerobically inclined or a high responder to aerobic work, man, the time spent there may need to be, you know, 90%. Mm-hmm. And then if your mechanics are already pretty good, maybe we don't need to spend as much time sprinting. Maybe you're sprint form is pretty good and your ability to sprint is going to come from your aerobic strength. And so we spend this massive amount of time building this physiological engine and we dabble in the sprint part of it. Mm-hmm. And also limiting factors, because we know that even the mile is mostly aerobic.
Yeah. Yeah. Which isn't, I mean, because I think that's the funny thing is like when you look at this sort of training program, I wouldn't think that the like primary adopters would be like 1500 meter runners, right? Where I feel like the Ingebrigtsens being so dominant, I mean, especially Jakob, it's like, it's a curious thing. Cause again, I think also like something I'm curious about to hear your take is, you know, like 180 kilometers a week is a lot of running in general. So, I mean, there's also the context of it. It's also just like a lot of running, and it seems to me like decently quality. Like I think they're saying that Jakob does a lot of his stuff around like 6 minute mile pace on the like off days, right, that aren't double threshold days. So there's just a lot of like really quality aerobic work throughout. I feel like there's yep. not a lot of jogging around.
Yeah, I think that back to like that 10 by 400 versus slowing down example, I think the reason that you can do that is that he's probably a little bit fresher all the time. And then the other thing is you got to look at like 6 minute pace for him is probably like.
Yeah. I think that's holding back. Fast. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, you know, I spent 30 days with Kipchoge. He runs way slower than that on his easy days.
Yeah.
Especially the doubles. So I don't know, man. I mean, it's just like back, it's almost like back to knowing the athlete and like asking continually that question, what does this person need to be the best that they can be? But yeah, clearly he's found, he doesn't seem to be the fastest guy in the field. Mm-hmm. Like with pure sprint speed.
Yeah.
And so he's found his niche of, I can be the strongest guy and there's a good chance I can run away from you with, you know, 400 to go after three laps have already happened.
Well, I think there's definitely something to be said to the efficacy of a training program also just being consistency over time. Like, does it set you up to not get injured, to be able to train for years and just progress and be like in a controlled manner? Like when I think now, listening to more like some of like the Norwegian like triathlon coaches and just a lot of like the Norwegian methodology, I think even say like the lactate measurements, I feel like they just have a general philosophy of trying to take a lot of information and just make like objective, the most objective decisions possible, right? And I think like a program that sets you up to just be able to make consistent progress, to kind of not get emotional about it too, of like really using some of those measurements to dictate the pacing so that you're not overrunning. Cause I think overrunning, I think, is probably the biggest problem that we have as endurance athletes, is like, we just want to, I think like we oftentimes just want to, and I think Jakob said this in an interview, like a lot of people want to feel faster than they are.
Yep. Right.
And I know I'm certainly guilty of that, and looking at it and listening to these guys, I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense in terms of just like making, and like when you're accumulating a lot of workload, like I think it's a cool thing to where you put your attention. So if you're putting your attention on one singular workout, is this being like a successful workout or like you failed the workout, and you're using that to be a measurement of like where you are all the time, I don't think that's as good of a place to put your attention as a opposed to say like something where you're just trying to accumulate like a lot of workload over the course of a week, over the course of a month, over the course of like your training block, right? And I feel like it's one of the things I like about the double threshold model is just the fact that it puts your attention on this cumulative workload as opposed to like the singular workout, right?
So I like what you said about the objective data.
Yeah.
Because if we think about like what Marius Bakken was talking about with, if the limiting factor is muscular fatigue,
yeah,
then how do we measure that? And it seems like the Norwegians have equated that muscular fatigue with the lactic acid values, and that those, even if they're not, directly related, they're at least correlated.
Yeah.
So you can measure your muscular fatigue based on a blood value that you can take immediately.
Yeah.
So hey, I actually recorded Ingebrigtsen's training and wrote it down. Do you think it would be cool if we pulled it up?
Yeah. Go for it.
Yeah, so this was taken from a video that I found on YouTube. We should link the video. I'll get it for you so we give credit where credit's due. But basically, Carmen did. She took all of this data, and this is what I kind of wanted to zero in on here, is this is the interesting part. So here are their lactate values that they're trying to accomplish in the training zones. So easy distance running, 0.2 to 2.0 millimoles per deciliter. And then there's the heart rate too, but I don't know that they're necessarily going off of heart rate very much other than as an observational value. I think they're going almost strictly off lactate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also an interesting thing, is like what metrics are you using to actually dictate your decision making, and which ones are all kind of like retroactively you're maybe looking back at to see, say, if like your heart rate didn't correlate, right? You're like, maybe we're over time getting more fatigued. Yeah. Like it's like, you're kind of just using those,
like as post hoc analysis.
Yeah. Like big picture stuff versus in the middle of a workout, we're like shutting it down.
Yeah. I know one of their rules that they talk about is when the reps are like a couple reps are slower than the previous, that's a sign to shut the workout down. But yeah, threshold. And this gives a couple different values. You can see morning 4 to 5 by 2K, 1 minute rest, 2.5. And then the evening 10 by a K, 1 minute rest, 3.5. So that gives some values there. And then the interval hill work is quite high.
Yeah.
So I almost feel like that they're getting that hard track workout, but they're getting it from the hill workout.
Yeah, totally. Which is, do you know why they're using hills? Because I do think that was something that seemed more specific to the Ingebrigtsens using hills, as opposed to like Bakken, I think, was using more variety of stuff.
I don't know why they're using hills. My guess would be that it has to do with just the form being really good. The hills force your form to be good. So yeah. it can't get out of control.
Yeah. Which again, I think that's like a little bit of an injury risk prevention as well, where you're getting strength as opposed to like, yeah, like all out. I think of the, like the most risky thing you can do is running all out intervals or like really high intensity intervals on the track.
I had this conversation with an athlete and a parent the other day that they were questioning why I gave short rest for intervals this time of year. And I was like, because 5 times a K with 4 minutes recovery is like one of the hardest workouts you can do.
Yeah.
Like you're going to be so thrashed from if you get after it. Too much recovery.
Yeah.
It's basically like 5 1K races if you go for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, here's a typical preparation period week. And you can see 5 times 6 minutes and then 10 times 1,000 in the afternoon on Tuesday. Then Thursday, 5x2K and 25x400. And then Saturday, the hill run. And then Sunday, long run. So this is even more intense than the D1 program that I was talking about.
Yeah. 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 Like, I mean, the 25x400 is and with the 30 seconds recovery. I actually kind of like that idea. I think most people wouldn't particularly enjoy doing that type of workout.
yeah that 30 seconds is so short. It's just enough time to finish, walk back to the line, and almost go again.
Yeah
And then this is what I was talking about for the pre-competition period, because you can see 10 by 300 1500 meter pace there, which would be a more typical workout. And then you can also see 20 by 400 in four sets, every set progress from 3,000 to 1,500 meter pace or faster. So again, I think it's really interesting to not pigeonhole the Ingebrigtsen system, quote unquote, just to double thresholds, because clearly you've got really some really aggressive workouts here.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think that that's like, I would be curious. One of the thoughts I had is, say for somebody wanting to get into double threshold training, like you can kind of just look at this, kind of look at their pre-competition training program and then kind of what they do to get ready for competition. But it's like, that's they've got this layer, especially when you're talking specifically about the Ingebrigtsens and Jakob, it's like he's got years of doing this sort of structured work, right? So it's like, I think where you start, if you were curious about starting it, I would say that even before you get into double threshold stuff, you probably need to layer down some quality, just like base running miles, don't you think?
Yeah, I do think that, like, if you're already in your, like, say you're in this preparation period and you're like, man, I would love to do double thresholds. One of the things that Ryan and Sarah taught me just through observing is doing a cross training double workout.
Yeah.
I think that's a great place to begin, is hop on the bike and do, you know, 10 times 3 minutes on, 1 minute off on a workout day.
Yeah.
As your second day. Like, I think that's the safest way to do it. And I actually would argue that, you know, I'm 42. I'm not doing double thresholds.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to try it, because I'm in the phase of, I want to prolong my career. Even if I gain 10 to 15 seconds improvement over my 5K, the risk for me is not worth it. Mm-hmm. So if I do a double day, I just hop on the bike or I swim or I do something else that has intensity with it.
Because you think that just the cumulative volume will just end up being too much?
I think this is almost 30 years of running a minimum of 50 miles a week.
Yeah.
Like, it's not worth the risk to me to add the volume.
Yeah. Well, what do you,
anyway,
what do you think about, because I think it's one thing to look at like a training methodology on paper and how it applies to elite runners. For like an amateur who's going to say, wake up early, do their first workout, and then presumably go about their day doing work, taking care of the kids, whatever, and then doing an afternoon workout, like they're not just sitting around all day, right? Kicking the legs up.
That's recovering. That's right. And that's why I think that if you're going to do it in that scenario, chances are it should either be on a Saturday and it should be once a week.
Yeah.
In lieu of a long run, or you can do it during the week, but just hop on the bike and, you know, go in your training cave in the basement. And I mean, you know, this, you can do a ton on the bike and not feel it.
Yeah. When I think of that, like when I think about the cross training in the afternoon versus a run, I just think of like running taking a lot of like, say, activation, getting loose beforehand. Like, I do think it takes a lot more time to be properly ready for like an afternoon workout. Not to mention, like, you got to be maybe a little bit more on top of what you're eating throughout the day, you know, like stomach issues become a bigger issue. So I do very much like the cross training and that effect, because I do think, say, something that's like cycling, something that's non-weight bearing, you're just not having a lot of those issues. I find that I could jump on the bike, get warmed up, and it's not, if I didn't do a bunch of activation and like rolling and stuff, it's not going to necessarily have any effect on the way my body feels. Like, it'll get loose regardless. I do like it. I would say my recommendation would be to like still try to keep the same sort of structure. Like you said, still trying to do sort of like interval style efforts on there. Cause I think it is the same sort of mentality of like, you allow yourself to actually go a touch harder and then drop that. Say if you were actually measuring, you would see like a drop in lactate levels during the recovery and then come back up, rather than just trying to sustain, which I think the underlying principle that I see there is that maybe things are just a little bit more quality than if you're trying to do sustained efforts all the time.
Yeah, I think the focus is easier. I think the fatigue level is probably easier to manage as well, like spiking up the fatigue level and letting it come back down. You're right. You get a faster effort and probably it's weird because you're going quicker, but I feel like you recover better.
Yeah.
I think that's the goal. I think the goal is to try and run as fast as you can and recover as well as you can. And I think that's why it's being accomplished, because it's at the right lactate level in terms of body chemistry. It's allowing your muscles to get a break, so you're not getting accumulative muscular fatigue. And it's just preparing you to be able to do that second session in the afternoon. But yeah, I love the idea of continuing with, you know, an elliptical, a swim, a bike interval session. And that goes back to what you were saying about swim coaches being influential in endurance sports and keeping tons of intervals going.
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing about the intervals is, like I had a coach when I was doing triathlons, whenever we were coming back from injury, and I still use this with my athletes, we would always do like, run walk intervals, just doing easy running, but you would have like a walk interval in the run to like essentially give your muscles and tendons and ligaments, everything, like a little bit of a break. And he was saying there's studies that showed that there was like a tremendous reduction in re-injury in that phase when you're doing that, just with that little bit of recovery, that it gives everything in your body just a chance to kind of catch up and not have to sustain the effort for, you know, say if you're coming back from injury, like you're just going for a 30-minute run, you add like a 1-minute walk interval in there to just kind of let it all cool down and then go again. I think in some sense there's like maybe a more intense version of that happening when you're doing, say, like breaking up tempo runs into like cruise intervals, where you're getting a little bit of recovery so that your muscles and tendons and everything aren't all just like being asked to contract over and over again for a sustained period of time.
Yeah, so, it's almost like we don't realize the fatigue level we're building.
Yeah, I think 100%. It would be, I mean, wouldn't that be great if you could actually just take measurements? You're like, oh, this muscle is like, you know, getting way overworked, like in my calf or something.
You know, I'm excited for the future because I think at some point we're going to have, it's not available yet. At some point we will have a continuous lactate monitor.
Yeah.
That's going to be the next level of training. I've asked the glucose monitor company that I bought mine from, and they said the technology is not there yet, but it will be eventually.
That's cool.
Like you'll be able to wear the arm thing and give you a continuous lactate number.
Yeah.
On your watch.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I like it. No, it's funny. I was listening to this guy Olav, who coaches Christian Blumenfeld and Gustav Iden, like two of the best triathletes in the world. And I would say it's funny because he's very Norwegian and like uses all this lactate measuring. It takes just a lot of measurements. But like to some extent in triathlon training, like double threshold training or doing multiple threshold training sessions in a day has always existed because it's like you have to, right? Like you have to hit these other modalities or these other, like you have to get in everything at some point during your week. So you just end up accumulating a lot of work. But he takes all these measurements and I was listening to him talk on Rich Roll, and that's a great interview, by the way, if you guys are interested. But he takes so many measurements, and I think Rich was asking about HRV and how that plays into it. And so much of it, what he said he ends up coming back to is just how the athlete feels.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's something that I think is really cool when you're looking at somebody who takes a ton of measurements, that obviously like really well-funded programs, but they're still really kind of coming back to like, ultimately we're making decisions based on how the athlete felt during the workout, how they felt, you know, getting ready for it. And there's more specifics, but I think that's a cool takeaway that like, we can all get more checked in with our body. And that was one of the things he said is like, that connection with your body and feedback from your body is one of the most underutilized metrics of like making decisions. So it's cool to take in all the information about like how to inform your training. And I think lactate is probably just one of those things that's so useful because I think that it probably shows where we're the most disconnected with like what proper training feels like, yep. Right?
I was thinking about your example of walking on the easy day. And if anybody ever runs in a city where you have lights that you have to stop at, I always feel so good like after that 1 minute break and then like I start back, like the pop in your legs comes back and your fluidity comes back. And so it's really interesting you bring that up in terms of a recovery. Like I'm probably going to use that especially for athletes coming back from injury in their and it sounds wimpy, right? Like I'm going to give you a 30 minute run and we're going to break it into, you know, 10 minutes with 2 minutes walk times three.
Yeah.
It's like, what? You're going to make me walk on a 30 minute run? That's stupid. But it makes a lot of sense, especially with an injury issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that like the principle that I see at work there that I think is so important and something that I think I realized it's so important because I really struggle with it. And I can kind of look back through various times of training, both on the bike and running, where I've gotten this so wrong, is like attaching your mental satisfaction to the right thing within your training. And I think that people really struggle with that, to say add a walk into their run, because they get so much satisfaction about the continuous running and accumulating a certain, you know, time, distance and pace, right? Ultimately what was my average pace on that run? And man, that's a hard thing to break. And I know that for myself, why I kind of like the double threshold methodology is just kind of breaking that, is bringing your attention to really about the efficacy of your training and what you're trying to accomplish and doing proper training as opposed to like trying to prove something in your training, right? Trying to prove that you're fit. Because that can really undermine the training program at large. So I think something like that, where it's like, and I think this is becoming a more prevalent thing, you know, like say you listen to Huberman, then you come away with all these hacks about how to mess with your dopamine system or something, you know. I do think that it's cool that I think there's this trend happening where we're getting a lot more focus on how can I essentially work, you know, work smarter and not harder. And I would challenge people to just like always be thinking about that with your training programs. Like, am I getting my satisfaction from the right place? Because I do think it's a cool thing when you change that mindset and you feel satisfied because you felt good in your workout and you don't feel like a zombie afterwards. And, you know, you feel good throughout your week. Maybe you mess with your nutrition and you see some positive changes. So, you know, and again, that body connection, like what feedback is your body giving you is, I think, so useful and something that we just have a tendency to get away from.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let me throw this up there real quick too. This is kind of cool. This is Ingebrigtsen's brother Henrik's training from 2014 and 2015, and we can actually link this to the episode. But I love looking at, especially when someone or a program is well known for one thing. I love trying to find elements in the program that they're not known for and like bring those to light, because we are too often enamored by the most popular thing at the moment. I think we all are. But I mean, you look at this Diamond League, Monaco, and Paris setup, and dude, there's a lot of training here that is fast. 300s, 200s, 150s. I mean, 10 by 300 averaging 41:59, that's a pretty fast workout. I mean, that's like 50, it's like 52 pace. So I just love the fact that, hey, we're highlighting here that you also have to run fast to be fast. You can't just do double threshold and rely solely on that. Because I mean, one of these workouts, 6 by 300, average 41:95 with 90 seconds rest. I mean, that's basically like running 52 for 6 by 400. I mean, that is it with 90 seconds rest. That's a very quick workout. So I just like bringing that to light, that like they're taking all elements of training. It's not just double thresholds and then you're going to be, world champ.
Like you still have to periodize your training, right? Like you can't just like you can't overly simplify it to one thing and just like leave it there. And then, but I
Right. And
think
I think we do that a lot, where people are like, I just need to run 100 miles a week. I mean, there's so much more to it than that. We can't just tag one thing and then go for it.
totally. And I mean, I kind of have some sympathy for that because it's like that's where things get confusing, is where you have to know when to hit certain types of training. But I think the great thing about that is like it seems like when they're hitting it really well and like in a very precise way, right? And maybe like to me, I feel like just looking at that, I feel like, oh, I could definitely feel like I could be able, like I could accomplish that if I've laid this huge aerobic base essentially, right? Like around your threshold is really quality. I think managing those workouts is probably easier at that point as well, where you can hit really high intensity and your body's like from a physiological standpoint set up to deal with it, right? And deal with the fatigue and recover well. as opposed to if you jumped into that immediately and started doing really hard workouts, your fatigue level might be entirely different.
Yeah. There's no, I mean, it's back to the kind of original idea that in coaching, education is like building a foundation. I think this is just an extension of that idea and understanding, okay, what does our foundation actually need to look like? Yeah. Now, instead of just running miles and you build a quote unquote base, this is still base training. It's just a more complex version of it and a more specific version. And that's hopefully what we're all trying to do, is get more and more specific, dig in better. And like Bakken was talking about, maybe, you know, a few years from now, the best in the world are going to be doing, you know, maybe it's going to be 6 by a K, or maybe it's going to be 8 by a K 3 times a day or something similar to that. Or maybe a progression with the 3, where the third workout of the day you're sprinting uphill. I don't know. I just think that there's always going to be a development. And that's the fun thing about it, is to like think about it and understand where that could be. And again, back to the idea of the individual athlete, continuing to ask that question as coaches with Run Free, with all of our athletes, what is going to benefit this person the most? What is their race? What are they going to do? And how can we continue to get better as coaches so we can be on that cutting edge?
Yeah. I agree. Funny thing in researching this is there's not a lot of information about if it applies to marathon training or if you can use it effectively for marathon training.
Thought about that a ton.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear your thoughts, because I just thought it was interesting. It seems to be somewhat absent. I've like found a little bit of people talking about it, but it seems to me like you probably could use it in some ways. And like Ryan does use, you know, cross training, I think, effectively for adding some more like quality threshold work. But it's like, if you, is the demand of the marathon such that you need those more continuous efforts to properly prepare for it? Like, is that, that's the one thing that I feel like kind of stands out to me.
I think the thing with the marathon that I've thought about the most is the energy demands. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we are limited on the amount of calories, even with our calorify episode. Mm-hmm. You know, we're limited on the amount of calories that we can process and consume. I think that comes into play with the marathon when the volume is so high that maybe you would be overdoing it at some point from a liver glycogen standpoint in a fueling replenishment. Whereas for 5K, 10K, like there's no reason to fuel. You're good.
So you're saying that like the types of workouts that you'd end up doing, if a typical miler does a certain amount of volume and double threshold is like taking that volume up pretty substantially, a marathoner, are you saying that it would be like your volume would have to come up, right?
My question is, is the marathoner at the upper limit of volume already?
Yeah.
And so how do we eat enough to fuel a double marathon workout?
Challenge accepted. I feel like the one benefit that I could see is maybe just and like we do this already to some extent, is like doing the intervals where they're not necessarily, you know, marathon style intervals a lot of times are not crazy fast, but you are doing a whole bunch of them. Like I've definitely done, I think, like 16 by a mile before. So I think we're maybe already utilizing some of that principles of like breaking up your threshold type work into interval sessions with recoveries in there as well. So you're actually able to run a little bit faster while still getting this cumulative volume and maybe reduction in injury? Because obviously, like, you can't just do 16 mile thresholds all the time, right? Like, to get that volume, you kind of have to start using some of that, breaking it up.
Yeah, that would be super cool if you could somehow get the volume slightly lower and add a greater total volume. So I don't know, maybe like 12 times a mile in the morning and then 10 by 800 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Get 17.
Yeah.
Instead of 16, and like starting to play with that. I mean, and this is not for everyone. This would be like for like, you know, like you or Rory or Bia or Sarah or somebody that has all day to work on recovery and do everything possible. But yeah. I think if we're talking about like one of our athletes that's trying to qualify for Boston or run, I don't think there's any reason for a double attempt at a double marathon workout. I think that would be probably overdoing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe just like the limitations of a marathoner might just not be in alignment with the limitations of like a middle distance runner, where like your anaerobic threshold is such a huge component of the latter, I'd say, for marathon. And this is interesting in thinking about having listened to like this guy Olaf talk about triathlon training, is you're talking about a whole different thing where you're also adding in like resistance to fatigue, where there's like, I think, a number of other factors that we don't even totally understand that are also playing into that, of like when you start to get past, you know, what is a, you know, actual threshold effort when you're doing a marathon, which, you know, for some people is, you know, 4+ hours. That's a different, you know, it's a different demand that you have compared to a 5K runner. Anything to add on your end, Jay?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. No, I think it'll just be interesting to see where it goes in the next like 10 years, like what developments happen. Because I feel like there's been some decently huge developments in training in the last 10 years.
Yeah, which is like relatively new. I mean, it's sort of funny when you start to look in training methodology and developments that have happened over the last, you know, decades. Like, it's not that far back that training was like pretty archaic, you know, and it's like, say, like the Lydiard model coming of like just making base training and base mileage such a big thing. It's like, that wasn't that long ago, you know, and it's funny to think about like kind of that we've, in some sense, been using a lot of the same traditional types of training for a long time.
Yeah. No, I think the biggest change that's going to happen is happening is on the nutrition side. Mm. I think the nutrition science and the genetic study of how genes allow us to absorb foods, like things like ketones and bicarb, and like those things are just, I think there's more of those out there that we're going to see develop in the future for sure.
Yeah. And like, I think probably, yeah, like more, like you were saying, with the continuous like lactate monitoring and already continuous glucose monitoring, like more, I think of like anytime you have more sophisticated measurements being taken, you just have more information and you can start to play around with that stuff in a more sophisticated way. Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Sweet. All right. We're going to call it good there.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I gotta roll.
All right. So Jay had to run, but I wanted to wrap up this episode with a few concluding thoughts about double threshold training. For one, I want to get into a little bit, if you're thinking about getting a lactate monitor, whether that's a worthwhile investment. So for one, price point, lactate monitors are typically going to run at the low end around $250. And that comes typically with about 25 test strips. If you want to get more test strips, they run about $50 for 25 test strips. So you're looking at about $2 a test strip. On the low end, and that price point can go up as well. Another alternative to that would be going into a lab and getting a lactate threshold test, and these run about $150 to $200 as far as I've been able to find. Obviously, that's dependent on your location and testing availability. Now, I would say I have a lactate monitor, and I've been playing around with it for the last few weeks, and I would say that for one, it can be a bit finicky, and it can be definitely hard to test yourself. What I've found is that my hit rate on an accurate test is probably like 1 in 5 getting started. And I think there's a learning curve to that. So I think it's something you do get better at. You kind of figure out how to do, properly. But I would say if your thought is that you're going to get a lactate monitor and test yourself, expect there to be a harsh learning curve, and obviously that ends up being pretty costly when you're looking at $2 a strip. So the way that I've been using it is essentially trying to get some correlation between my heart rate and lactate numbers. So then what I can do is then use heart rate maybe more effectively. So ultimately, I think what you have to work with is with lactate, there's another number available that can help inform your training. And I do think this is very worthwhile to do. And that's why I think it might be potentially a good investment to go into a lab and get tested, just so you have an idea of how all those things correlate, right? Like where your lactate numbers lie in correlation to your heart rate, in correlation to your pace, in correlation to your perceived exertion. And then you can kind of coordinate all those numbers together to inform your pace on the day. Try to hit the right pace for you that will essentially allow you to recover and allow you to get the best training load that you possibly can. And I think that, as I stated earlier in the episode, that probably one of the places that I know for myself I've definitely gotten wrong, and I see this with a lot of athletes, is I think we typically think that we need to be working harder than we actually need to when, at least in terms of addressing our anaerobic threshold, which is one of the big takeaways for me in looking into this double threshold training more deeply, is that for myself, I found that the lactate numbers that I'm seeing at effort levels that I would typically run at are actually higher than I would have expected them to, and has given me a little bit more leeway to back off the pace a little bit and overload the volume a bit more, because I'm finding that I'm not getting as fatigued from each session, and can thus recover a little bit more quickly, and can get more total volume over the course of a week. So then a good follow-up question to that might be, can you do double threshold training effectively without any lactate monitoring at all? So I would say that it is possible that lactate threshold in terms of your anaerobic threshold is correlated with roughly what pace you can run for 45 minutes to an hour. So a real quality race will give you a good reading in terms of pace, what kind of number you can hit. And I think then that also can, if you have accurate heart rate on the data on that race as well, can give you a good heart rate value there. So I think those can be good numbers to use in place of any lactate threshold testing. Obviously, testing is going to give you the most detailed analysis because you're just actually seeing where those numbers are. But I think for most people, it's probably totally fine to swap out at race effort. I would suggest if you're, a 45 minute to an hour race is not always accessible, especially if you're not in peak fitness. Running a hard 45 minute hour effort takes a lot out of you. So on the website, we do have our pacing calculator, and in there you can put in a variety of race distances, put in a maximal effort, and it'll give you equivalent race efforts. And what I would do is, if you're a really well-trained athlete and you've been training for years, I would find a equivalent race that's around about an hour and what pace that is. And that's probably going to be roughly about your threshold pace. And if you're a younger athlete, maybe, or you're just not as highly trained, I would pick an equivalent race distance that's more close to a 45 minute race effort. And that's probably going to be around about your threshold pace. And then what I would do after that is use that pace to start hitting some of these workouts. Say if you're hitting 5 by 6 minutes or 6 by 5 minutes or 10 by 3 minutes. You can go ahead and I think and implement that pace, and you should be able to feel if it's a sustainable effort or not, and then start to track your heart rate over time. And I think what you can see is that typically your heart rate will stabilize at those sort of efforts, and you should see over time similar heart rates. And hopefully if you're getting fitter, you might see that heart rate drop over time. But I found that sometimes when I feel fatigued, that also correlates with either a higher heart rate, or maybe sometimes I feel like I just can't get my heart rate high, but the perceived exertion is high. So you can kind of see where fatigue plays into your workouts. It might impact your heart rate, it might not. And that's where I think perceived exertion can be a really valuable thing to pay attention to. But I think that's a good place to start if you're looking at trying to do double threshold training without getting any lactate testing. I think probably the biggest problem that people will run into trying to implement double threshold training is maybe being like a little bit overly optimistic or being overly aggressive about it. And that's one of the things I also want to talk about, the specific lactate measurement readings that the Ingebrigtsens use and the Bakken uses. So as we stated earlier, that a lot of times their morning session would be about 2.5 millimoles per deciliter and their afternoon session would be 3.5 millimoles. Bakken said that he would typically shoot for about 3 millimoles. And this is deviating a little bit. He thought that the typical anaerobic threshold from the literature is considered around 4 millimoles per deciliter. And he thought that those numbers were skewed by more amateur runners and weren't representative of where most elite runners' actual lactate threshold would lie, or their anaerobic threshold. So what does this mean? Well, I think that that means that these paces are not actually super fast. And I think there's a big risk of maybe trying to do double threshold training and potentially overrunning it. Because I think that's where you could get into trouble, is if you're thinking about threshold as being a really hard effort. Because in some ways, I think just the word threshold sounds hard. And when you think about half marathon pace, that sounds hard. But in terms of lactate numbers, these numbers are not particularly high. Like 4 millimoles would be a typical anaerobic threshold, where your first session is hardly over LT1, which might even be considered like low tempo or zone 2 work. And then 3.5 millimoles being more towards your anaerobic threshold, or potentially over by just a little bit if you're a more elite athlete. But I think the lesson here is that probably we should all be erring on the side of going a little bit more conservative in our workouts than we would like to. And that allows you to recover faster, you know, doing multiple sessions in a day, more sessions per week, and that just accumulates in a higher volume overall. So there's definitely a trend of trying to get a bigger cumulative workload than trying to hit one big workout. So I hope that answers some potential questions you guys might have. Feel free to hit us up on social media if you have any follow-up questions. Happy to help out where we can. And let us know if you guys try to do this double threshold training. I'd be very curious to hear how it goes for you. All right, till next time.